Cooper's parties and banquets, which had become legendary for their opulence, their debauchery, and the volume of champagne consumed. Troopers went door to door carrying red donation boxes. Donors received little badges to pin on their clothing to show they had given money, and they made sure to wear them, thereby putting oblique pressure on those brave or foolhardy souls who failed to contribute. Another American ran afoul of the government due to a false denunciation by persons who had a grudge against him, according to a consulate report. It was the kind of moment that decades hence would become a repeated motif in films about the Nazi era. At about 4:30 in the morning on Tuesday, December 12, 1933, an American citizen named Erwin Wallstein stood on a train platform in Breslau, waiting for a train to Oppen in Upper Silesia, where he planned to conduct some business. He was leaving so early because he hoped to return later that same day. In Breslau, he shared an apartment with his father, who was a German citizen. Two men in suits approached and called him by name. They identified themselves as officers of the Gestapo and asked him to accompany them to a police post located in the train station. "I was ordered to remove my overcoat, coat, shoes, spats, collar, and necktie," Wallstein wrote in an affidavit. The agents then searched him and his belongings. This took nearly half an hour. They found his passport and quizzed him on his citizenship. He confirmed that he was an American citizen and asked that they notify the American consulate in Breslau of his arrest. The agents then took him by car to the Breslau Central Police Station, where he was placed in a cell. He was given a frugal breakfast. He remained in his cell for the next 9 hours. In the meantime, his father was arrested and their apartment searched. The Gestapo confiscated personal and business correspondence and other documents, including 2 expired and canceled American passports. At 5:15 that afternoon, the 2 Gestapo agents took Wallstein upstairs and at last read him the charges filed against him, citing denunciations by 3 people whom Wallstein knew: his landlady, a second woman, and a male servant who cleaned the apartment. His landlady, Miss Bleicher, had charged that 2 months earlier he had said, "All Germans are dogs." His servant, Richard Kühne, charged that Wallstein had declared that if another world war occurred, he would join the fight against Germany. The third, a Miss Strauss, charged that Wallstein had loaned her husband a communistic book. The book, as it happened, was Oil by Upton Sinclair. Wallstein spent the night in jail. The next morning he was permitted to confront his denouncers face to face. He accused them of having lied. Now, unprotected by the veil of anonymity, the witnesses wavered. The witnesses themselves appeared to be confused and not sure of their ground, Wallstein recalled in his affidavit. Meanwhile, the U.S. consul in Breslau reported the arrest to the consulate in Berlin. Vice Consul Raymond Geist in turn complained to Gestapo Chief Rudolf Diels and requested a full report on Wallstein's arrest. That evening, Diels telephoned and told Geist that on his orders, Wallstein would be released. Back in Breslau, the 2 Gestapo men ordered Wallstein to sign a statement declaring that he would never be an enemy to the German state. The document included a magnanimous offer that if he ever felt his safety endangered, he could report for arrest under protective custody. He was released. Martha assigned herself the task of trimming the family tree, an enormous fir placed in the ballroom on the second floor of the house. She enlisted the help of Boris, Bill, Butler Fritz, the family chauffeur, and various friends who stopped by to help. She resolved to have a tree that was entirely white and silver, and so bought silver balls, silver tinsel, a large silver star, and white candles, eschewing electric lights for the more traditional and infinitely more lethal approach. In those days, she wrote, it was heresy to think of electric lights for a tree. She and her helpers kept pails of water nearby. Her father, she wrote, was bored with all this foolishness and avoided the project, as did her mother, who was busy with myriad other holiday preparations. Bill was helpful to a point, but he had a tendency to drift away in search of more engaging pursuits. The project took 2 days and 2 evenings. Martha found it funny that Boris was willing to help, given that he claimed not to believe in the existence of God. She smiled as she watched him at work atop a stepladder, dutifully helping her trim a symbol of the foremost holy day of the Christian faith. "My darling atheist," she recalled telling him, "why do you help me decorate a Christmas tree to celebrate the birth of Christ?" He laughed. "This isn't for Christians or for Christ, liebes Kind," he said, "only for pagans like you and me. Anyway, it is very beautiful. What would you like?" He sat at the apex of the ladder. "Do you want me to put my white orchids on top? Or would you prefer a handsome red star?" She insisted on white. He protested. "But red is a more beautiful color than white, darling." Despite the tree and Boris and the overall cheer of the season, Martha felt that a fundamental element was absent from her life in Berlin. She missed her friends, Sandberg and Wilder, and her colleagues at the Tribune, at her comfortable house in Hyde Park. By now her friends and neighbors would be gathering for cozy parties, caroling sessions, and mulled wine. On Thursday, December 14th, she wrote a long letter to Wilder. She felt keenly the withering of her connection to him. Just knowing him gave her a sense of credibility, as if by refraction she too possessed literary cachet. But she had sent him a short story of hers, and he had said nothing. "Have you lost even your literary interest in me? Or shall I say your interest in the literary me, what there is left of it, if there was anything to begin with? And your trip to Germany, has it been definitely passed up? Gosh, you have certainly given me the slip," to lapse back into Berlin slang for a moment. She had done little other writing, she told him, though she had found a certain satisfaction in talking and writing about books, thanks to her new friendship with Arvid and Mildred Harnack. "Together," she told Wilder, "we have concluded we are the only people in Berlin genuinely interested in writers." Mildred and she had begun their book column. "She's tall and beautiful, with a heavy burden of honey-colored hair, dark honey in some lights. Very poor and real and fine and not much in favor, though the family is old and respected. An oasis, really, to me, mad with thirst." She alluded to her father's sense that a conspiracy was mounting against him from within the State Department. "Mazes of hate and intrigue in our embassy have as yet failed to trap us," she wrote. Hatreds of a more personal kind had touched her as well. In America, her secret marriage to Bassett and her equally secret effort to divorce him had become public knowledge. "Nasty what my enemies cooked up about me in Chicago," she told Wilder. One woman in particular, whom Martha identified as Fanny, had begun spreading especially unpleasant rumors out of what Martha believed to be jealousy over Martha's publication of a short story. "She insists that you and I have had an affair, and it has come back to me from two people. I wrote to her the other day pointing out the dangers of slander unfounded, and indicated the mess she might get into." She added, "I feel sorry for her, but it does not alter the fact that she is a rather slimy-mouthed bitch." She sought to capture for Wilder a sense of the wintry city outside her windows, this new world in which she found herself. "The snow is soft and deep-lying here, a copper smoke mist over Berlin by day, and the brilliance of the falling moon by night. The gravel squeaks under my window at night. The sinister-faced, lovely-lipped, and gaunt Diels of the Prussian secret police must be watching, and the gravel spits from under his soft shoes to warn me. He wears his deep scars as proudly as I would fling about in a wreath of Edelweiss." She expressed a deep and pervading sorrow. "The smell of peace is abroad, the air is cold, the skies are brittle, and the leaves have finally fallen. I wear a pony coat with skin like watered silk and muff of lamb. My fingers lie in depths of warmth. I have a jacket of silver sequins and heavy bracelets of rich corals. I wear about my neck a triple thread-like chain of lapis lazuli and pearls. On my face is softness and content, like a veil of golden moonlight. And I have never in all my lives been so lonely. Though Martha's reference to mazes of hate was a bit strong, Dodd had indeed begun to sense that a campaign was gathering against him within the State Department, and that its participants were the men of wealth and tradition. He suspected also that they were assisted by one or more people on his own staff, providing intelligence in sotto voce fashion about him and the operation of the embassy. Dodd grew increasingly suspicious and guarded, so much so that he began writing his most sensitive letters in longhand because he did not trust the embassy stenographers to keep their contents confidential. He had reason to be concerned. Messersmith continued his back-channel correspondence with Undersecretary Phillips. Raymond Geist, Messersmith No. 2 officer, another Harvard man, also kept watch on the affairs of Dodd and the embassy. During a stop in Washington, Geist had a long and secret conversation with Wilbur Carr, chief of consular services, during which Geist provided a wide range of intelligence, including details about unruly parties thrown by Martha and Bill that sometimes lasted until 5 in the morning. On one occasion, the hilarity was so great, Geist told Carr, that it drew a written complaint to the consulate. This prompted Geist to call Bill into his office, where he warned him, if there was a repetition of that conduct, it would have to be reported officially. Geist also offered a critique of Ambassador Dodd's performance. The ambassador is mild-mannered and unimpressive, whereas the only kind of person who can deal successfully with the Nazi government is a man of intelligence and force who is willing to assume a dictatorial attitude with the government and insist upon his demands being met. Mr. Dodd is unable to do this. The arrival in Berlin of a new man, John C. White, to replace George Gordon as counselor of embassy, could only have increased Dodd's wariness. In addition to being wealthy and prone to hosting elaborate parties, White also happened to be married to the sister of Western European Affairs Chief J. Pierpont Moffat. The two brothers-in-law carried on a chummy correspondence, calling each other Jack and Pierpont. Dodd would not have found the opening line of one of White's first letters from Berlin to be terribly reassuring. There appears to be a spare typewriter around here, so I can write to you without other witnesses. In one reply, Moffat called Dodd a curious individual whom I find it almost impossible to diagnose. To make matters even more claustrophobic for Dodd, another new officer, Orm Wilson, who arrived at about the same time to become a Secretary of Embassy, was Under Secretary Phillips's nephew. When the Chicago Tribune printed an article about Dodd's request for leave in the coming year, along with conjecture that he might quit his post, Dodd complained to Phillips that someone within the department must have revealed his leave request, intending harm. What especially galled Dodd was a comment in the article attributed to an unnamed State Department spokesman. The article stated, "Permanent retirement from the post of ambassador to Germany is not contemplated by Professor Dodd. It was insisted here." With the perverse logic of publicity, the denial actually raised the question of Dodd's fate. Would he retire, or was he being forced from his post? The situation in Berlin was difficult enough without such speculation, Dodd told Phillips. I believe von Neurath and his colleagues would be considerably displeased if this report were forwarded to them. Phillips replied, with his now familiar textual smirk, I cannot imagine who gave the Tribune information regarding your possible leave next spring, he wrote. Certainly no one has asked the question of me. One of the principal joys of the newspaper world is to start gossip about resignations. At times we all suffer from that phobia, and do not take it seriously. In closing, Phillips noted that Messersmith, who was then in Washington on leave, had visited the department. Messrs. Smith has been with us for a few days, and we have had some good talks on the various phases of the German situation. Dodd would have been right to read those last lines with a degree of anxiety. During one of these visits to Phillips's office, Messrs. Smith provided what Phillips described in his diary as an inside glimpse of conditions in the embassy in Berlin. Here, too, the subject of Martha and Bill came up. Apparently, Phillips wrote, the ambassador's son and daughter are not assisting the embassy in any way and are too much inclined to running around to nightclubs with certain Germans of not particularly good standing and with the press. Messrs. Smith also met with Moffat and Moffat's wife. The three spent an afternoon talking about Germany. We went over it from all angles, Moffat wrote in his diary. The next day he and Messrs. Smith had lunch, and several weeks later they met again. During one conversation, according to Moffat's diary, Messrs. Smith claimed to be much concerned at letters received from Dodd indicating that he was turning against his staff. Dodd's recently departed counselor, George Gordon, happened to be on a lengthy leave in the United States at the same time as Messrs. Smith. Though Gordon's relationship with Dodd had begun badly, by now Dodd grudgingly had come to see Gordon as an asset. Gordon wrote to Dodd, our mutual friend, GSM, meaning Messrs. Smith, has been staging a most active campaign in support of his candidacy for the legation at Prague. Messrs. Smith had long hoped to leave the Foreign Service behind and become a full-fledged diplomat. Now, with the embassy in Prague available, he saw an opportunity. Gordon noted that a torrent of letters and newspaper editorials testifying to Messrs. Smith's sterling work had begun flowing into the department. A familiar touch was imparted to all this, Gordon wrote, when I heard that he had told one of the high officials that he really was a little embarrassed by all the press eulogies of himself, because he did not like that kind of thing. Gordon added in longhand, O sancta virginitas simplicitasque, Latin for such pious maidenly innocence. On December 22nd, a Friday, Dodd got a visit from Lewis Lochner, who brought troubling news. The visit itself was not unusual, for by now Dodd and the Associated Press bureau chief had become friends and met often to discuss events and exchange information. Lochner told Dodd that an official high in the Nazi hierarchy had informed him that the next morning the court in the Reichstag trial would declare its verdict, and that all but van der Lubbe would be acquitted. This was stunning news by itself, and if true, would constitute a serious blow to the prestige of Hitler's government, and in particular to Göring's standing. It was precisely the botch Göring had feared. But Lochner's informant also had learned that Göring, still incensed at Dimitrov's impudence during their courtroom confrontation, now wanted Dimitrov dead. His death was to occur soon after the end of the trial. Lochner refused to identify his source, but told Dodd that in conveying the information, the source hoped to prevent further damage to Germany's already poor international reputation. Dodd believed the informant to be Rudolf Diels. Lochner had come up with a plan to scuttle the assassination by publicizing it, but wanted first to run the idea past Dodd, in case Dodd felt the diplomatic repercussions would be too great. Dodd approved, but in turn consulted Sir Eric Phipps, the British ambassador, who also agreed that Lochner should go ahead. Lochner weighed precisely how to execute his plan. Oddly enough, the initial idea of publicizing the impending assassination had been brought to him by Göring's own press adjutant, Martin Sommerfeld, who also had learned of the imminent murder. His source, according to one account, was Putzi Hanfstengel, though it is entirely possible that Hanfstengel learned of it from Diels. Sommerfeld told Lochner that he knew from experience that there is one way of dissuading the general. When the foreign press claims one thing about him, he stubbornly does the opposite. Sommerfeld proposed that Lochner attribute the story to an unimpeachable source, and stressed that the murder would have far-reaching international consequences. Lochner faced a quandary, however. If he published so inflammatory a report through the Associated Press, he risked enraging Goering to the point where Goering might shut down the AP's Berlin bureau. It was far better, Lochner reasoned, to have the story break in a British newspaper. He, Sommerfeld, and Hampfstengel revised their plan. Lochner knew that a very green reporter had just joined the Berlin bureau of Reuters. He invited him out for drinks at the Adlon Hotel, where Hampfstengel and Sommerfeld soon joined them. The new reporter savored his luck at this apparently chance convergence of senior officials. After a few moments, Lochner mentioned to Sommerfeld the rumor of a threat against Dimitrov. Sommerfeld, as per plan, feigned surprise. Surely Lochner had gotten it wrong, for Goering was a man of honor, and Germany was a civilized land. The Reuters reporter knew this was a big story, and asked Sommerfeld for permission to quote his denial. With a great show of reluctance, Sommerfeld agreed. The Reuters man raced off to file his story. Late that afternoon, the report made the papers in Britain, Lochner told Dodd. Lochner also showed Dodd a telegram to the foreign press from Goebbels, in which Goebbels, acting as spokesman for the government, denied the existence of any plot to murder Dimitrov. Goering issued his own denial, dismissing the allegation as a horrid rumor. On December 23rd, as Lochner had forecast, the presiding judge in the Reichstag trial announced the court's verdict, acquitting Dimitrov, Torgler, Popov, and Tanev, but finding van der Lubbe guilty of high treason, insurrectionary arson, and attempted common arson. The court condemned him to death, while also stating, despite masses of testimony to the contrary, that van der Lubbe's accomplices must be sought in the ranks of the Communist Party, that communism is therefore guilty of the Reichstag fire, that the German people stood in the early part of the year 1933 on the brink of chaos into which the communists sought to lead them, and that the German people were saved at the last moment. Dimitrov's ultimate fate, however, remained unclear. At last came Christmas Day. Hitler was in Munich. Goering, Neurath, and other senior officials likewise had left Berlin. The city was quiet, truly at peace. Streetcars evoked toys under a tree. At midday, all the Dodds set out in the family Chevrolet and paid a surprise visit to the Lochners. Louis Lochner wrote in a round-robin letter to his daughter in America, "We were sitting together drinking our coffee when suddenly the whole Dodd family, the ambassador, Mrs. Dodd, Martha, and young Mr. Dodd, snowed in on us just to wish us Merry Christmas. That was awfully nice of them, wasn't it? I like Mr. Dodd the more I work with him. He's a man of profound culture and endowed with one of the keenest minds I have come in contact with." Lochner described Mrs. Dodd as a sweet, womanly woman who, like her husband, far rather visits with a family of friends than go through all the diplomatic shallow stuff. The Dodds don't pretend to be social lions, and I admire them for it. Dodd spent a few moments admiring the Lochner's tree and other decorations, then took Lochner aside and asked for the latest news of the Dimitrov affair. "Dimitrov thus far appeared to have escaped harm," Lochner said. He also reported that his highly placed source, whose identity he still would not reveal to Dodd, had thanked him for handling the matter so deftly. Dodd feared further repercussions, however. He remained convinced that Diels had played a key role in revealing the plot. Dodd continued to be surprised by Diels. He knew his reputation as a cynic and opportunist of the First Order, but he found him time and again to be a man of integrity and worthy of respect. It was Diels, indeed, who earlier in the month had persuaded Goering and Hitler to decree a Christmas amnesty for inmates of concentration camps who were not hardened criminals or clearly dangerous to state security. Diels's precise motives cannot be known, but he considered that time, as he went from camp to camp selecting prisoners to be freed, one of the best moments of his career. Dodd feared that Diels might have gone too far. In his diary entry for Christmas Day, Dodd wrote, "The secret police chief did a most dangerous thing, and I shall not be surprised later to hear that he has been sent to prison." In traveling about the city that day, Dodd was struck anew by the extraordinary German penchant for Christmas display. He saw Christmas trees everywhere, in every public square and every window. One might think, he wrote, the Germans believed in Jesus, or practiced his teachings. 1934. Part 5. Disquiet. Chapter 28. January 1934. On January 9th, the primary defendant in the Reichstag trial, Marinus van der Lubbe, received word from the public prosecutor that he was to be beheaded the next day. "Thank you for telling me," van der Lubbe said. "I shall see you tomorrow." The executioner wore top hat and tails and, in a particularly fastidious touch, white gloves. He used a guillotine. Van der Lubbe's execution provided a clear, if gory, punctuation point to the Reichstag fire saga, and thereby quelled a source of turbulence that had roiled Germany since the preceding February. Now anyone who felt the need for an ending could point to an official act of state. Van der Lubbe had set the fire, and now van der Lubbe was dead. Dimitrov, still alive, was to be flown to Moscow. The way was clear for the restoration of Germany. As the year opened, Germany did seem, on a superficial level, to have grown more stable, much to the disappointment of foreign observers and diplomats who still nurtured the belief that economic pressures would cause the collapse of the Hitler regime. At the end of his first year as Chancellor, Hitler seemed more rational, almost conciliatory, and went so far as to hint that he might support some form of non-aggression pact with France and Britain. Anthony Eden, Britain's Lord Privy Seal, travelled to Germany to meet with him, and, like Dodd, came away impressed with Hitler's sincerity in wanting peace. Sir Eric Phipps, Britain's ambassador to Germany, wrote in his diary, "Herr Hitler seemed to feel a genuine sympathy for Mr. Eden, who certainly succeeded in bringing to the surface of that strange being certain human qualities which for me had hitherto remained obstinately dormant." In a letter to Thornton Wilder, Martha wrote, "Hitler is improving, definitely." This sense of looming normalcy was apparent in other spheres as well. The official tally of unemployed workers showed a rapid decline, from 4.8 million in 1933 to 2.7 million in 1934, although a good deal of this was due to such measures as assigning one-man jobs to two men and an aggressive propaganda campaign that sought to discourage women from working. The wild concentration camps had been closed, thanks in part to Gestapo chief Rudolf Diels. Within the Reich Ministry of the Interior, there was talk of doing away with protective custody and concentration camps altogether. Even Dachau seemed to have become civilized. On February 12, 1934, a representative of the Quakers, Gilbert L. McMaster, set out to visit the camp, after having been granted permission to see an inmate, a 62-year-old former deputy of the Reichstag named George Simon, who had been arrested because he was a socialist. McMaster caught a train in Munich, and half an hour later got off in the village of Dachau, which he described as an artist's village. From there he walked another half hour to reach the camp. He was surprised by what he found. "More atrocity reports have come from this camp than any other one in Germany," he wrote. "The outward appearance, though, is better than any camp I have seen." The former gunpowder plant in which the camp was located had been built during the past World War. There were good houses for the chemists and the officers. The barracks for the workers were more stable, and the whole plant was steam-heated, McMaster saw. "This makes Dachau seem better equipped for the comfort of the prisoners, especially in cold weather, than the provisional camp in an old factory or farmhouse. In fact, the appearance of the whole is more that of a permanent institution than that of a camp." The inmate, Simon, was soon brought to the guardhouse to meet with McMaster. He wore a gray prison suit and seemed well. "He had no complaint," McMaster wrote, except that he was suffering a great deal from acute rheumatism. Later that day, McMaster spoke to a police official who told him the camp housed 2,000 prisoners. Only 25 were Jews, and these, the official insisted, were held for political offenses, not because of their religion. McMaster, however, had heard reports that at least 5,000 prisoners were housed within, and that 40 to 50 were Jews, of whom only one or two had been arrested for political offenses. Others had been arrested following denunciations by people who wanted to injure them in business, and others because they were accused of associating with non-Jewish girls. He was surprised to hear the official say that he saw the camps as temporary and would welcome the day when they could be done away with. McMaster found Dachau even had a certain beauty. "It was a very cold morning," he wrote. "There had been such a dense fog the night before that I had a hard time finding my hotel. This morning there was a perfect blue sky. Bavarian colors were white for the clouds and blue for the Bavarian sky, and the fog of the night before covered the trees with a thick hoarfrost. Everything was coated with a glistening lace of ice crystals that gave the camp an ethereal look, like something from a fable. In the sun, the birches of the surrounding moor became spires of diamond." But as in so many situations in the New Germany, the outward appearance of Dachau was misleading. The cleanliness and efficiency of the camp had little to do with a desire to treat the inmates in a humane fashion. The preceding June, an SS officer named Theodor Eicke had taken command of Dachau and composed a set of regulations that later became the model for all camps. Issued on October 1, 1933, the new rules codified the relationship between guards and prisoners, and in so doing removed the act of punishment from the realm of impulse and caprice to a plane where discipline became systematic, dispassionate, and predictable. Now everyone at least knew the rules, but the rules were harsh and explicitly left no room for pity. "Tolerance means weakness," Eicke wrote in the introduction to his rules. "In the light of this conception, punishment will be mercilessly handed out whenever the interests of the fatherland warrant it. Minor offenses drew beatings with a cane and stints in solitary confinement. Even irony was costly. 8 days solitary and 25 strokes were meted out to anyone making depreciatory or ironical remarks to a member of the SS, deliberately omitting the prescribed marks of respect, or in any other way demonstrating unwillingness to submit himself to disciplinary measures." A catch-all clause, Article 19, dealt with incidental punishments, which were to include reprimands, beatings, and tying to stakes. Another section laid out the rules for hangings. Death was the penalty for anyone who, for the purpose of agitating, discussed politics, or was caught meeting with others. Even collecting true or false information about the concentration camp, or receiving such information, or talking about it with others could get an inmate hanged. "If a prisoner attempts to escape," Eicke wrote, "he is to be shot without warning." Gunfire also was the required response to prisoner uprisings. "Warning shots," Eicke wrote, "are forbidden on principle." Eicke made sure all new guards were fully indoctrinated, as one of his trainees, Rudolf Hoss, would later attest. Hoss became a guard at Dachau in 1934 and recalled how Eicke repeatedly drummed home the same message. "Any pity whatsoever for enemies of the state was unworthy of an SS man. There was no place in the ranks of the SS for men with soft hearts, and any such would do well to retire quickly to a monastery." He could only use hard, determined men who ruthlessly obeyed every order. An adept pupil, Hoss went on to become commandant at Auschwitz. At first glance, persecution of Jews seemed also to have eased. "Outwardly, Berlin presented during my recent stay there a normal appearance," wrote David J. Schweitzer, a senior official with the American Joint Distribution Committee, nicknamed the Joint, a Jewish relief organization. "The air is not charged, general courtesy prevails. Jews who had fled during the previous year now actually had begun returning, he wrote. Some 10,000 Jews who had left in early 1933 had returned by the start of 1934, though outbound emigration, 4,000 Jews in 1934, continued as well. So much is this the actual situation, or so well masked is it, that I heard an American, one who was just spent a week passing on to a neighboring country, remark that he could not see that anything has actually happened that so stirred the outside world. But Schweitzer understood that this was, in large part, an illusion. Overt violence against Jews did appear to have receded, but a more subtle oppression had settled in its place. What our friend had failed to see from outward appearances is the tragedy that is befalling daily the job holders who are gradually losing their positions, Schweitzer wrote. He gave the example of Berlin's department stores, typically owned and staffed by Jews. While on the one hand one can observe a Jewish department store crowded as usual with non-Jews and Jews alike, one can observe in the very next department store the total absence of a single Jewish employee. Likewise, the situation varied from community to community. One town might banish Jews, while in the next town over, Jews and non-Jews continued to live side by side with their neighbors and pursue their occupations as best they can, unmolested. Likewise, Schweitzer detected divergent outlooks among Berlin's Jewish leaders. The one tendency is that there is nothing to hope for, that things are bound to get worse, he wrote. The other tendency, however, is quite the opposite, but just as definite, namely a tendency resulting from thinking in terms of March 1934 instead of March 1933. Reconciling themselves to the present situation, accepting the status of the inevitable, adjusting themselves to move in their own restricted circles, and hoping that just as things have changed from March 1933 to March 1934, they will continue to improve in a favorable manner. Hitler's continued protestations of peace constituted the most blatant official deception. Anyone who made an effort to travel the countryside outside Berlin knew it at once. Raymond Geist, acting consul general, routinely made such journeys, often on a bicycle. Before the end of 1933, during my frequent excursions, I discovered outside of Berlin on nearly every road leaving from the city new, large, military establishments, including training fields, airports, barracks, proving grounds, anti-aircraft stations, and the like. Even the newly arrived Jack White recognized the true reality of what was occurring. Anyone motoring out in the country of a Sunday can see brown shirts drilling in the woods, he told his brother-in-law Moffat. White was astonished to learn that the young daughter of a friend was required to spend every Wednesday afternoon practicing the art of throwing hand grenades. The superficial normalcy of Germany also masked the intensifying conflict between Hitler and Rome. Dodd and others who had spent time in Germany knew full well that Hitler was intent on increasing the size of the regular army, the Reichswehr, despite the explicit prohibitions of the Treaty of Versailles, and that Captain Rome of the SA wanted any increase to include the incorporation of entire SA units, part of his campaign to gain control of the nation's military. Defense Minister Blumberg and the army's top generals loathed Rome and disdained his uncouth legions of brown-shirted stormtroopers. Göring hated Rome as well, and saw his drive for power as a threat to Göring's own control of Germany's new air force, his pride and joy, which he was now quietly but energetically working to construct. What remained unclear was where exactly Hitler stood on the matter. In December 1933, Hitler made Rome a member of his cabinet. On New Year's Eve, he sent Rome a warm greeting, published in the press, in which he praised his longtime ally for building so effective a legion. "You must know that I am grateful to destiny, which has allowed me to call such a man as you my friend and brother-in-arms." Soon afterward, however, Hitler ordered Rudolf Diels to compile a report on the outrages committed by the SA and on the homosexual practices of Röhm and his circle. Diels later claimed that Hitler also asked him to kill Röhm and certain other traitors, but that he refused. President Hindenburg, the supposed last restraint against Hitler, seemed oblivious to the pressures building below. On January 30, 1934, Hindenburg issued a public statement congratulating Hitler on the great progress Germany had made in the years since his ascension to Chancellor. "I am confident," he wrote, "that in the coming year you and your fellow workers will successfully continue and with God's help complete the great work of German reconstruction, which you have so energetically begun, on the basis of the new, happily attained national unity of the German people." And so the year began, with an outward sense of better times ahead, and for the Dodds, a fresh round of parties and banquets. Formal invitations arrived on printed cards and envelopes, followed as always by seating diagrams. The Nazi leadership favored an awkward arrangement in which tables formed a large rectangular horseshoe, with guests arrayed along the inside and outside of the configuration. Those seated along the inside flank spent the evening in an abyss of social discomfort, watched from behind by their fellow guests. One such invitation arrived for Dodd and his family from their neighbor, Captain Röhm. Martha later would have cause to save a copy of the seating chart. Röhm, the Hausherr, or host, sat at the top of the horseshoe and had full view of everyone seated before him. Dodd sat at Rome's right, in a position of honor. Directly across the table from Röhm, in the most awkward seat of the horseshoe, was Heinrich Himmler, who loathed him. Chapter 29. Sniping. In Washington, Undersecretary Phillips called J. Pierpont Moffett into his office to read a whole series of letters from Ambassador Dodd, as Moffett noted in his diary. Among these were recent letters in which Dodd repeated his complaints about the wealth of Foreign Service officers and the number of Jews on his staff, and one that dared to suggest a foreign policy that America should pursue. "The nation," Dodd had written, "must discard its righteous aloofness, because another life-and-death struggle in Europe would bother us all, especially if it was paralleled by a similar conflict in the Far East, as I believe is the understanding in secret conclaves." Dodd acknowledged Congress's reluctance to become entangled abroad, but added, "I do, however, think facts count, even if we hate them." Although Phillips and Moffett were disenchanted with Dodd, they recognized that they had limited power over him because of his relationship with Roosevelt, which allowed Dodd to skirt the State Department and communicate directly with the President whenever he wished. Now, in Phillips's office, they read Dodd's letters and shook their heads. "As usual," Moffett wrote in his diary, "he is dissatisfied with everything." In one letter, Dodd had described two of his embassy officers as competent but unqualified, prompting Moffett to snipe, "whatever that may mean." On Wednesday, January 3rd, Phillips, his tone remote and supercilious, wrote to Dodd to address some of Dodd's complaints, one of which centered on the transfer of Phillips's nephew, Orm Wilson, to Berlin. Wilson's arrival the previous November had caused an upwelling of competitive angst within the embassy. Phillips now chided Dodd for not managing the situation better. "I hope it will not be difficult for you to discourage any further talk of an undesirable nature amongst the members of your staff." As to Dodd's repeated complaint about the work habits and qualifications of foreign servicemen, Phillips wrote, "I confess I am at a loss to understand your feeling that somebody in the department is encouraging people in mistaken attitudes and conduct." He cited Dodd's past observation that there were too many Jews on the embassy's clerical staff, but professed to be somewhat confused as to how to resolve the issue. Dodd previously had told him he did not want to transfer anyone out, but now it appeared he did. "Do you desire any transfers?" Phillips asked. He added, "If the racial question is one that needs correction in view of the special conditions in Germany, it will be perfectly possible for the department to do this upon definite recommendation from you." That same Wednesday in Berlin, Dodd wrote a letter to Roosevelt that he deemed so sensitive he not only wrote it in longhand, but also sent it first to his friend Colonel House, so that House could give it to the president in person. Dodd urged that Phillips be removed from his position as undersecretary and given a different sort of posting, perhaps as an ambassador somewhere. He suggested Paris, and added that Phillips's departure from Washington would limit a little the favoritisms that prevail there. He wrote, "Do not think I have any personal axe to grind or any personal grievances about anything. I hope, it is the public service alone that motivates this letter." Chapter 30 Premonition. Martha became consumed with Boris. Her French lover, Armand Berard, upon finding himself consigned to the background, grieved. Diels, too, receded, though he remained a frequent companion. Early in January, Boris arranged a tryst with Martha that yielded one of the most unusual romantic encounters she had ever experienced. Though she had no advance warning of what was to occur, other than Boris's plea that she wear his favorite dress, gold silk, off the shoulders, deep and revealing neckline, close-fitted at the waist. She added a necklace of amber and a corsage that Boris had provided of gardenias. Fritz, the butler, greeted Boris at the front door, but before he could announce the Russian's presence, Boris went bounding up the stairway to the main floor. Fritz followed. Martha was just then walking along the hall toward the stairs, as she wrote in a detailed recollection of the evening. Upon seeing her, Boris dropped to one knee. "Oh, my darling," he said in English, then in German, "you look wonderful." She was delighted and mildly embarrassed. Fritz grinned. Boris led her out to his Ford, the top raised mercifully against the cold, and drove them to Horcher's restaurant on Lutherstrasse, a few blocks south of the Tiergarten. It was one of Berlin's finest restaurants, specializing in game, and was said to be Göring's favorite place to dine. It was identified also in a 1929 short story by then-popular writer Gina Kaus, as the place to go if your goal was seduction. You could be seated on one of its leather banquettes, and a few tables over there would be Göring, resplendent in his uniform of the moment. In another time there might have been famous writers, artists, and musicians, and prominent Jewish financiers and scientists, but by this point most had fled or else had found themselves suddenly isolated in circumstances that did not permit costly nights on the town. The restaurant endured, however, as if unmindful that anything had changed in the world outside. Boris had reserved a private room, where he and Martha dined lavishly on smoked salmon, caviar, turtle soup, and chicken in the style coming to be known as Kievsky. For dessert, they had brandied Bavarian cream. They drank champagne and vodka. Martha loved the food, the drink, the lofty setting, but was perplexed. "Why all this, Boris?" she asked him. "What are we celebrating?" In answer, he gave only a smile. After dinner, they drove north and turned onto Tiergartenstrasse, as if heading for the Dodds' house, but instead of stopping there, Boris kept driving. They tooled along the darkly forested boundary of the park until they reached the Brandenburg Gate and Unter den Linden, its 200-foot width clogged with automobiles whose headlights transformed it into a sluiceway of platinum. One block east of the gate, Boris pulled to a stop at the Soviet embassy at Unter den Linden 7. He led Martha into the building and along several corridors, then up a flight of stairs, until they stood before an unmarked door. He smiled and opened the door, then stepped aside to let her pass. He switched on a table lamp and lit two red candles. The room reminded her at first of a student's residence in a dormitory, though Boris had done what he could to make it something more. She saw a straight-backed chair, two armchairs, and a bed. Over the pillow he had spread an embroidered cloth that he identified as coming from the Caucasus. A samovar for making tea occupied a table by the window. In one of the corners of the room, in a bookcase, Martha found a collection of photographs of Vladimir Lenin centered around a single large portrait that showed him in a manner Martha had not seen before, like a friend captured in a snapshot, not the stern-visaged Lenin of Soviet propaganda. Here, too, lay a number of pamphlets in Russian, one with the scintillating title, as translated by Boris, Workers and Peasant Inspection Team. Boris identified all this as his Lenin corner, his Soviet equivalent of the religious images that Orthodox Russians traditionally hung high in one corner of a room. My people, as you may have read in the Russian novels you love, used to have and still have icon corners, he told her. But I am a modern Russian, a communist. In another corner she found a second shrine, but the centerpiece of this one she saw was herself. Boris called it his Martha Corner. A photograph of her stood on a small table, shimmying in the red flicker of one of Boris's candles. He also had set out several of her letters and more photographs. An enthusiastic amateur photographer, he had taken many pictures during their travels around Berlin. There were keepsakes as well, a linen handkerchief she had given him, and that stalk of wild mint from their picnic in September 1933, now dried but still exuding a faint tang. And here, too, was the carved wooden statue of a nun that she had sent to him as a reply to his three see-no-evil monkeys. Except Boris had accessorized the nun by adding a tiny halo fashioned out of fine gold wire. More recently he had added pine cones and freshly cut evergreen boughs to his Martha shrine, and these filled the room with the scent of forest. He included these, he told her, to symbolize that his love for her was evergreen. "My God, Boris," she laughed, "you are a romantic. Is this a proper thing for a tough communist like you to do?" Next to Lenin, he told her, "I love you most." He kissed her bare shoulder, and suddenly became very serious. "But in case you don't understand yet," he said, "my party and country must always come first." The sudden shift, the look on his face, again Martha laughed. She told Boris she understood. "My father thinks of Thomas Jefferson almost the way you do about Lenin," she said. They were getting cozy when, suddenly, quietly, the door opened, and in stepped a blonde girl, whom Martha guessed to be about 9 years old. She knew at once this had to be Boris's daughter. Her eyes were just like her father's, extraordinary, luminous eyes, Martha wrote, though in most other ways she seemed very unlike him. Her face was plain, and she lacked her father's irrepressible mirth. She looked somber. Boris rose and went to her. "Why is it so dark in here?" his daughter said. "I don't like it." She spoke in Russian, with Boris translating. Martha suspected the girl knew German, given her schooling in Berlin, but that she spoke Russian now out of petulance. Boris turned on an overhead light, a bare bulb. Its harsh glow instantly dispersed the romantic air he had managed to create with his candles and shrines. He told his daughter to shake Martha's hand, and the girl did so, though with obvious reluctance. Martha found the girl's hostility unpleasant, but understandable. The girl asked her in Russian, "Why are you so dressed up?" Boris explained that this was the Martha he had told her about. She was dressed so nicely, he said, because this was her very first visit to the Soviet embassy, and thus a special occasion. The girl appraised Martha. A hint of a smile appeared. "She is very pretty," the girl said. "But she's too thin." Boris explained that nonetheless Martha was healthy. He checked his watch. The time was almost 10 o'clock. He sat his daughter in his lap, held her close, and gently ran his hand through her hair. He and Martha spoke of trivial matters as the girl stared at Martha. After a few moments, Boris stopped, stroking her hair, and gave her a hug, his signal that it was time for her to go to bed. She curtsied, and in grudging, quiet German said, "Auf Wiedersehen, Fräulein Martha." Boris took the girl's hand and walked her from the room. In his absence, Martha gave his quarters a closer examination, and she continued doing so after his return. Now and then she glanced in his direction. "Lenin was very human," he said, smiling. "He would have understood your corner." They lay on the bed and held each other. He told her of his life, how his father had abandoned his family, and how at 16 he had joined the Red Guard. "I want my daughter to have an easier life," he said. He wanted the same for his country. "We've had nothing but tyranny, war, revolution, terror, civil war, starvation. If we aren't attacked again, we may have a chance to build something new and unique in human history. You understand?" At times, as he told his story, tears slipped down his cheeks. She was used to it now. He told her his dreams for the future. "Then he held me close to his body," she wrote. "From below his collarbone to his navel, his honey-colored hair covered him, as soft as down. Truly, it was beautiful to me, and gave me a deep feeling of warmth, comfort, and closeness." As the evening came to an end, he made tea and poured it into the traditional cup, clear glass in a metal frame. "Now, my darling," he said, "in the last few hours you have had a small taste of a Russian evening." "How could I tell him," she wrote later, "that it was one of the strangest evenings I had ever spent in my life?" A sense of foreboding tempered her enjoyment. She wondered whether Boris, by becoming so involved with her, establishing his Martha corner in the embassy, and daring to bring her to his private quarters, had somehow transgressed an unwritten prohibition. She sensed that some malevolent eye had taken note. It was, she recalled, as if a dark wind had entered the room. Late that night, Boris drove her home. Chapter 31 Night Terrors. The lives of the Dodds underwent a subtle change. Where once they had felt free to say anything they wished within their own home, now they experienced a new and unfamiliar constraint. In this their lives reflected the broader miasma suffusing the city beyond their garden wall. A common story had begun to circulate. One man telephones another, and in the course of their conversation happens to ask, "How is Uncle Adolf?" Soon afterward, the secret police appear at his door and insist that he prove that he really does have an Uncle Adolf, and that the question was not in fact a coded reference to Hitler. Germans grew reluctant to stay in communal ski lodges, fearing they might talk in their sleep. They postponed surgeries because of the lip-loosening effects of anesthetic. Dreams reflected the ambient anxiety. One German dreamed that an SA man came to his home and opened the door to his oven, which then repeated every negative remark the household had made against the government. After experiencing life in Nazi Germany, Thomas Wolfe wrote, "Here was an entire nation infested with a contagion of an ever-present fear. It was a kind of creeping paralysis which twisted and blighted all human relations." Jews, of course, experienced it most acutely. A survey of those who fled Germany, conducted from 1993 through 2001 by social historians Eric A. Johnson and Karl-Heinz Reuband, found that 33% had felt constant fear of arrest. Among those who had lived in small towns, more than half recalled feeling such fear. Most non-Jewish citizens, however, claimed to have experienced little fear, In Berlin, for example, only 3% described their fear of arrest as constant. But they did not feel wholly at ease. Rather, most Germans experienced a kind of echo of normality. There arose among them a recognition that their ability to lead normal lives depended on their acceptance of the Nazi regime and their keeping their heads down and not acting conspicuously. If they fell